second of tonight's speakers, who's Charlotte.
Hey, I'm Charlotte, I'm an addict. And, nervous. And, but this is how it works. I was feeling nervous and kind of a bit self-obsessed. Thank you very much for taking the meeting, and thank you, Victor, for a blinding chair. And that was kind of why I'm sitting here thinking our minds are going to be shit. Because I'm an addict, and that's how I work. And what happens is my sponsor is sitting in front of me. Two really lovely women come up and give me a hug. You know, there are people I know here. It's where I belong. And, yeah, I'm nervous, and that's fine. That's fine, it's whatever. But what I was thinking as I got here today, with the weather changing, I haven't put alcohol or drugs in my body for 7 years, as of 2 weeks ago. And it was the weather change. This time, 7 years ago, I was street homeless. I had been wearing the same clothes I was wearing for the last 2 weeks, and I remember exactly what they were. It was a pair of jeans, a t-shirt, and a pair of sandals. And suddenly it was cold, and I was scared. And that, for me, that was the end of it. That was the end of the line. And I kind of wanted to start with that, not to kind of prove why I'm here, but just that at this time of year, I have spectacular amount of gratitude for this beautiful, nuts, wonderful fellowship that we're in, and for everybody sitting here. There's this line. I haven't really thought about what I was going to say, because I think, for me, the best shares that I've heard, what really helps me is when something comes completely from the heart. And I have been in this fellowship, lock, stock and barrel, for 7 years, and I have thought about this stuff. I have tried to live it the best I can each day, and I have screwed up a lot. I've made bad mistakes, but they have been learning ones, and the mistake I haven't made is that I haven't picked up. And I know that if I do, and it is just such a just for today thing, if I do, there's a place to come back where I will be loved, and where, because I know, you know, the ultimate respect, the newcomer is the most important person in this room. And when I see people coming back from relapse and they're full of shame and fear and, you know, just scared, all I feel is love for that person and, you know, immense respect for the bravery and courage it takes to come back. And just really glad to see them. That's it, really. So kind of where to begin. This is a very democratic illness. And it is illness. I am convinced of it. This disease of addiction, this thing that cripples us and wishes us dead, is in me, and it will always be in me, and I will always need meetings, and I'm glad that I will always need meetings, because without them, my head gets narrow and small. It's something Victor said about, you know, this thing, I really identified with that thing about if I stop going to meetings, when I start going back to them, I start judging again. And it was absolutely spot on. And then I will stop going to as many meetings. And then I will think I can do it on my own. And then I'm screwed. I am the youngest of four kids. My parents loved each other. My parents weren't alcoholic or addict. You know, it was a kind of a happy house. And, you know, it was like it was cool. And sad stuff happened. You know, it's easy to matter. I love this thing in the readings about, you know, it's not about what we did, who we knew, what we used, blah, blah, blah. We are people trying to recover from this disease. And sad stuff happened. I am an addict, and I had traits of an addict since I was tiny, and they're still there, that if I got something that I wanted, it would change my life. And that could have been a toy when I was a kid. It could have been anything, but all I knew is that I really, really wanted it. And if I had it, it would be okay. Life would suddenly be fine. And it just wasn't. It's never been the case. It has never been the case. When I was about 16, my father was diagnosed with, I was saying this to Mark earlier, he was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. And he was 45 years old, and he started dying from the age of 45 and losing his memory. And I started running on grief. It's when I picked up alcohol. It is when I started to kind of lose the to be really scared and to lose the will to know, to lose the will to know how to control my life, to lose the will to do things, I don't know if it's even the will, the power to do things steadily, or I was just scared. And my experience of the addicts I've spoken to is that we run on fear, and I still do to a large extent. But I have got a program, and I have got a set of steps that helps me deal with my fear. A set of steps that my first sponsor said to me, the steps will help you know yourself and know your illness, end of. And they are, you know, I sound like that kid on the fast train, you know, that kid that used to go around saying, I love my mum, she's great, she's great, she's great. I feel that way because I love recovery. I was on the tube coming over here and I was thinking, recovery is the most important thing to me in my life. And then I'm thinking, is that right? You know, I've got these two boys who are 15 and 17. I was thinking, no, they're the most important things in my life. And then I thought, it's not rocket science. They wouldn't be in my life if I didn't have recovery. Mm-hmm. And they were, I didn't have them for a while. I need to be very, I've learned to be sensitive when I'm talking about my kids, because at the beginning of my recovery, when I first got them back, I was so overwhelmed to have them back in my life. And I would go on and on about how great it was and how brilliant. And one time there was this guy, I saw him and I was doing a share and he was crying. And I spoke to him afterwards and he said, I've lost my kids, I'm not going to get them back. And I felt terrible. I just felt so insensitive and, you know, like I've been boasting. And this guy has them back. 2 years down the line, he's got them back. And so I, you know, I want to give a message of hope. I want to give a message of hope and recovery. So, sort of, long story short, I don't want to talk too much about my using, but it is important for... I'm a drug addict, and a recovering drug addict and a recovering alcoholic. And I knew I had a problem with alcohol when I was about 16, 17. I couldn't stop drinking. I'd go to a party, and all the rest of the kids would be doing what they're doing, and I would just not want to stop. I didn't want to stop. I didn't want to go home. I didn't want... And that carried on. And, you see, I picked up coke when I was about 18... my behaviour was really erratic. It's the same old same, you know. And by 21, I was suicidal. I had burned a lot of bridges already and behaved really badly, hurt people, blah, blah, blah. And I tried to commit suicide when I was 21, and it was something I didn't talk about for years. So I didn't talk about that until I came into rehab. I just held it down, held it in. I will sort this out. I will sort this out. Got married really young to a lovely man who, you know, again, anyone who knows me in this room, I always pay him respect in these meetings, because he's not an addict. He is my ex-husband as of 10 years. And one of the things I'm most proud of is our relationship, because it is how our boys, you know, grow and blossom, and they don't have to suffer as a result anymore of how I was. And my relationship with my ex-husband is the way it is because I do meetings, because I have the steps, because I have a sponsor, because I am not perfect and I can be furious and whatever, but we sort it out. And he kept those boys safe. He kept them safe. Ultimate respect. And he loved them when I couldn't be there. And basically what happened was my dad was getting more and more ill. I started drinking. By this stage, I couldn't stop. We'd moved out of London, we had moved to a beautiful house, you know, I had the lot, the beautiful house, the girls, the gorgeous kids, the loving husband, the whole thing. I know about happiness, and I have learned that happiness, it's that old chestnut, that it is an inside job. Happiness does not come from the beautiful house, the beautiful cars, the beautiful this or that. And I had to lose all of that to learn it. And so I started drinking, I couldn't stop. I went into my first rehab and came out, relapsed the second I came out, and started drinking myself to death. I took half the rehab out with me and we all just partied at home. And, you know, there was a day, you know, my husband came downstairs and there was coke on the table and the kids were asleep upstairs and he said, enough, can't do this, need a divorce. And he knew how ill I was, and I don't think he said later. He said, I never stopped loving you, but I couldn't bear it. I could not bear to watch you kill yourself. So he found me somewhere to live, and I holed up there, and I started to drink myself to death in earnest. And I went into a rehab that I was given 6 weeks to live around alcohol. So I cleaned up my act with that, stopped drinking, fell in love with a crack addict in the rehab. That was always a blinding move. Always, I've made such wise decisions around men, I tell you. And came out, we stayed clean for about 3 weeks, and doozy. But the classic one about that was apparently these kind of rehab relationships, they're supposed to, you know, they're supposed to last about 6 months. That's kind of standard. I had great pride that it lasted 6 years, and it was hell. And, but I was proud, you know, I'm a stayer. And so we came out, and I had this filth, I had a divorce settlement that to me felt like blood money. It felt like money that I'd been paid to leave, you know, because I had fucked up and I'd lost my kids. And we spent a lot, and we smoked a lot, and we stuck a lot of our noses. And it was, at the beginning he was dealing some coke, and I still wasn't drinking, it was just horrible. And doing masses of coke with no alcohol, and then crack, no alcohol, and no Valium, nothing. And, you know, I know about hell, I know about addiction, and I know about hell. And this guy was angry, and, you know, it was just bad news, all of it, and very lonely and very scary. And all the time, in the back of my head, these two little boys who need their mum. And they would come, my ex-husband would bring them a couple of times a week, and they would arrive, their little faces, fresh-faced, sweet, with Aeromite bags, and they would come up because he knew I needed them as much as they needed me, and I would hold it down. I would not use when they were there. And I knew while I was giving them their baths and putting them in their beds that my boyfriend was smoking crack, and that's where I wanted to be. And that, the spiritual, that was the rock bottom. You know, the street stuff, the whatever, that was the rock bottom, the emotional rock bottom of not being able to love the things, to love those boys for whom my heart beats, knowing I would swim an ocean for them, but I was drowning. And that was the killer. So then heroin crept in, and I was in a lot of pain, and heroin was a lot of medicine, and I started using that, and then it was escalated to hell, then the lot went, and then I picked up alcohol. So, and that's when I ended up street homeless, and I was insane by that stage, and there was some kind of peace around it. It was the strangest feeling. I had lost everyone. No one knew where I was. I didn't have a mobile phone. I was gone. And I was kind of glad. And that, you know, if this is not slowly committing suicide, then I don't know what is. By the grace, you know, and I was arguing, you know, standard stuff. I was in doorways, I was whatever, and I was being scraped up by the police, and they were really kind of helpful. I'd be sitting in the cell, and they'd be trying to find somewhere to put me, and they, you know, just this pity in everyone's eyes, and contempt from the general public, and all of that lot. And anyway, I eventually, and I was trying to stop all the time, and I couldn't, you know, it was just game over. And I found my way. The only people helping me was my eldest brother, who is also in recovery. He was 10 years, you know, he wasn't actually, he was about 5 years sober. Everyone was telling him to stay away, and he was the one who would come and rage at me, "You are the worst addict I've ever seen," he'd say. Like, "Have you ever seen a good one?" And "You're the worst one I've ever seen, and I hate you, and look, and you're wearing lipstick," he said to me one time, like, you know, because he just wanted this disheveled kind of creature that would go, "Oh, no." And I had still that kind of thing, like, "I've got to get my drugs, I've got to keep it together somehow." So anyway, he was doing that, and then my boyfriend, who was using at the time, was stealing cars, trying to find me, scouring the streets, all this malarkey, and he gets me in, so I get scraped up and put into, on the 3rd of October, 95, I walked up the stairs to this crisis intervention centre, and I had made sure that day I had as many drugs and as much alcohol in my system as I could possibly cram in. And I couldn't walk. I was so ill, I could barely walk. And the man that opened the door is a man who is in the rooms and who I see a fair amount of. And those defining moments in our lives, I will never forget what those steps looked like. You know, it wasn't even something I consciously thought about. But in my head, those metal steps walking up, that was the day I got clean. And I just wanted to say something about this room. There's this book that I really love, and in it, there's this kid, and he's watching people coming back from war, and they're battered, and they're torn, and they're whatever. And in this book, there's this line, and he says, "Behind each, there is a spirit like the rising of the sun." And I found that line so moving, because it's what I see here. You know, it's extraordinary, this fellowship. We're all here trying to get clean, trying to live a spiritual life. And it's astonishing. It is just, it blows me away every time. So anyway, I quite fancied this counsellor who'd let me in. So he said, "Come to a meeting." So I went, "Yeah, right." And so we went to a meeting. I don't think I listened to anything, actually. I just sort of kind of looked at him a bit and kind of didn't really listen. Anyway, but I kept going to meetings. And I remember my first meeting, which was at Waterloo, and it was a candlelit meeting. And for the first time, I sat there and I heard... for the first time, my ears were open, and you know, in all the rehabs I've done, and they used to say to me, "Take the cotton wool out of your mouth and put it in your ears," or something. I can't remember what it was, but you get the gist. It was like, stop talking and start listening. And I only managed to do that. That happened naturally to me when I was in the rooms, because in the rooms I was hearing people who were there because they just desperately wanted to get clean, and people who had been clean a while, and people who were carrying a good message. And people who thought the way I thought, and background and education, whatever, forget it. It's, we have the same illness. And I was hearing people who felt the same way and had found, and who were were destroying themselves the same way, and had found a solution to stop it and to start living and to start building a life again. And I got my first commitment there. And it was a tea commitment. Now, I work in the fashion business. I've been in it for a long time, and I've had some quite glamorous jobs in my time. And this is the humility in it. There's me in my kind of T-shirt and my sandals and the pouring rain, borrowing hoodies from the guy behind the, you know, desk at the hostel. And, you know, this is all good. This is all good. Because that humility, we live in this world, I'm no better, no worse than a single human being in this world. And it's a really beautiful lesson to learn in life. And I started doing meetings. I get this commitment, and I found a sponsor, and I started working the steps. And this is where I get the far show about, they bring me on the steps, because I just love the steps. I love them, and they are, for me, they have been the most. I did so many rehabs. I did so many. I did therapy. I did all of this stuff, and God bless it all. It took me out, and I am so grateful to a country where we. You know, I remember seeing my counsellor talking to this woman about how they were going to find some kind of funding for housing or whatever. And I just remember just thinking, looking at them, just thinking, I have fucked up. I had, you know, the lot, I fucked up. And they're sitting there really kind of seriously considering how to help. And I was so astounded. You know, it's amazing. It's, people are kind, I have discovered. And... again, that's a beautiful lesson. Like my ex-husband always says, kindness is the most underrated virtue. And there is so much of it here. Those two lovely women who came up to me and said, "You're going to be all right. Do you know what my spot?" You know, all of it. The kindness I've been showed. The first chair I did was in Brixton. It was 22 guys. I was shitting myself. And I sat there and I'm like, "Hello, my name's Charlotte and I'm Natty." And I just thought, I'm going to get pelted with tomatoes and it's just going to be, oh, they'll just be horrible to me. It was like, and the warmth that came back, I must have been 6 months clean, and the warmth that came back, and the friends I've made in this fellowship, and the love that is here, and the compassion, is, you know, I mean, if I live to be a very old woman, I just will, you know, it's astonishing, it's beautiful, and I was battered, and I was insane, and I had lost a lot. Anyway, so there's... that's all that. Now, and this is the good news. It's a kind of timed it, okay, so it's like 20 minutes. There, so, yes, the good news, the solution. I got a sponsor. I was still certifiably insane. I was still in this vicarage I was staying at. It was like I was in a kind of third-stage vicarage for 10 months, and I couldn't work, and I was surrounded by people in recovery, and it was the best time. I was still sneaking my using boyfriend through the window, and if it, I would have been back out on the street. I mean, you know, it's still nuts. And still, you know, understandably, no one, I don't believe that anyone can come in here sane and honest. I just haven't seen it. And the people that say they're sane and honest, I kind of think, yeah, right. And wait. So anyway, I certainly wasn't. And but the stuff I was, Mark, you might have to look after it. Yeah, sorry, my dog. What I was doing was I was beginning to work a program, and I started looking at the steps. I've got two brothers and a sister. They're older than me. Now, the brother that's not in recovery, I've shared this a lot because I love this. The brother that's not an addict came in to, I was sitting, you know, a few months in recovery, lost a lot, blah, blah, blah. And he picked up the working guide, the NA Green and Gold Step Working Guide. He looked through it, and he got to the step four bit, and he was reading the questions, and he just said, Charlie, and I have shared this a lot, so forgive me, but it really moved me. He said, Charlie, you know, he said, I am just an ordinary guy. And he said, there's all this darkness, there's all this stuff that I don't understand about myself that makes me unhappy. And I don't know how to look at it. And he said, and you've got this. And he said, you are so lucky. And I adore my brother, and he watched me destroy myself. And it's a classic one, because early on in recovery, again, I looked at him and I had big eyes, and he was going, you know, I said, you know, Max, you know, in the end, no one knew how to help me. Already dramatic. And he just looked at me stone cold in the eye, and he went, Charlie, no one wanted to. Oh, ouch, ouch. And it was perfect, because this is the truth. This is the truth of it all. People get sick and tired of us, you know, and rightly so. I have a pain in the arse, and I, you know, just a nightmare. And, oh, God, I'm really sorry, and, oh, God, no, and blah, blah. Or just not even bothering saying that, just lying and swerving. And the steps, you know, I'll talk about them because I love them. The step one, yeah, kind of, I think most of us have got that almost nail when we come in. It's kind of, you know, yeah, all right, tell me what I don't know. And the powerlessness, I learned about powerlessness in recovery, believe. You know, I haven't used in over 7 years. But by that, I mean I haven't used drink and drugs. And I have used plenty of other things. And they bring as much pain, but I do not have the medication anymore. So I kind of have to learn how to stop using things that hurt me, and to recognise what I'm doing. My faith is deepens every day. What can I say? You know, it is ongoing. I had that whole thing in early recovery of being clean, of just loving, you know, looking at the sky or looking at, you know, to be looking into a tree or to be just a piece, and that beautiful kind of feeling of there is something bigger and benign out there, because if there wasn't, I wouldn't be here. That sense of this is a miracle what's going on here, and thank you. That was big. And so with that, and only that small kind of but strong feeling, starting working through the steps, and this beautiful, I love the work guide, I love the way it second guesses everything. When I'm working with my sponsor, my beautiful sponsor, or with sponsees, it's nuts the way I will do a question and then be talking about something. And then the next question will ask exactly what we've just been talking about. I mean, it knows an addict head inside out. And the step three I still have to use on a regular basis. I said, you know, before I started sharing, I said to my sponsor, I'm feeling nervous. And it's ego. That's all it is. I want to be liked. I don't want to be judged. I want to be this. I want to be that. No. And it's ego. And the step three with all of that is chuck it out. Just chuck it out. Do the best you can. Share from the heart. Share experience. Whatever strength I have. And hope, of which I have an abundance. The four, beautiful. I have a sponsor just starting it. And she was really scared before. And she is loving doing it. And it was the most extraordinary, surprising, beautiful thing. Because it wasn't the stuff I was scared of looking at. It was the stuff that came up and just caught me by surprise. It was stuff about writing about stuff when I was a kid that made me feel suddenly so lonely. Just to be writing some little thing. You know, my parents, I begged and nagged my parents to be allowed to go to my brother's school. I was the only girl there for a while. And because I begged and nagged, I couldn't back down. That has been my pattern in life's well, pride. I will beg and nag for something, then I'll get it, and then I'm in trouble, but I can't back down. And but writing about that when I was about 9 it was that loneliness, and it was that loneliness that I carried through as an adult, and that was that loneliness I was seeking to medicate a lot of the time, and the grief around writing about my dad was really strong. The one huge thing in the last rehab I did was when I was asked, I was doing a list of consequences, you know, I'm sure many of you know them, and I was reading them like a shopping list, yeah, and this, I've done this, and this has happened, and I suddenly had this spiritual awakening, and I recognised that what I felt was the most massive anger and grief at my father for dying. Huge, huge. And if I could start to look at all of that at step four and start to recognise why I needed this huge amount of medicine, I'm in with a fighting chance of not using it again. And then on it goes. Six, in, you know, my defects of character, the things that don't work for me. Again, surprising. Impulsive texting, top of the list. Still do it. And you know, the stuff that causes me embarrassment, I spent a lot of recovery feeling deeply embarrassed about stupid things. And people are quite kind. So if I can admit them and confess and just feel like an idiot and again, the kindness comes in. And I love my fellow people, you know, other recovering addicts get it, you know, that's it. And the amends, the first amends, I did try and hang around with them. I mean, some of them I did want to dash in and do, and I didn't. I stuck about. I was told quite early on, wait, just wait, because people have been so sick of hearing you say sorry, just hang on. But the amend I did, which I am really glad, the proper one, the living one, was to my ex-husband and to my children. And it took a long time. He's sane, he's, you know, and he loves me, and he knew that the children needed me and I needed them, but it was a slow process. And every single morning, I was living in Streatham, and I caught the train, and they lived in Fulham, and I was back there. You know, I'd get the train every single day and get there on time and show up and be consistent. And for the kids, that's all they needed. They just needed me there, consistent. Every night at bath time, I had to leave them, and every night at bath time, my heart broke, and I had to go back in the dark on the train back to Streatham and leave my kids. I didn't use, and I just kept doing it, and just kept doing it, and finally, you went through all the right channels and systems, and I found, and I got benefits, and blah, 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 and I found myself a place in Fulham, 5 minutes away from my ex-husband. They still live with their dad, but I live there too, kind of, I'm in and out, I'm with somebody else, but I'm kind of in and out, you know, I'm there every day for them, and they're my kids. And I want to say their names because it just brings them into the room. And their names are Jack and Theo, and they are 17 and 15, and they are just beautiful. And I just want my faces in my head because I have this real strong thing that if all of this went, I need all of this, I need it desperately. But if I have my higher power and I have those boys' faces in my head, I can do anything. I can do anything, but I can only do it. I'm an addict, and I'm ill, and I will always be ill. And we can recover. I don't believe we ever are recovered, but we can recover on a daily basis. And I need all this to help me. They are confident and happy. It took me about a year to ask my ex-husband how they were, and he said that Theo had been waiting in bed every night and was... he's a musician and he just did nothing but play his music all the time. He's a pianist and that was all he did. Jack wouldn't allow anyone to touch him. If you put your hand on him, you know, this is the damage I've done and this is the damage I was seeking to mend. And they're great now. They're loving and confident and happy and they love what I do here. They ask about it a lot. I mean, one time, this was like about 5 years ago, I was walking down the road with Jack, so he's 12 at this point, and he goes, "Mom, when you smoke crack, is it like having a party in your head?" and I just went, it is not a party you want to go to, believe me. You know, but I love the fact that they are confident enough and safe enough to ask me this stuff. And I won't lie, I don't give them the gory details. There's no need, but I don't lie, and they feel safe. And it's this consistency. And the 11, you know, the 10 I need, I don't do it often enough. I run it through my head, but I don't do it often enough, which is quite often by the end of the day, I'm feeling kind of like, oh, God, what's going on? But if I check it all out, I can figure it out quite fast. The thing about the 11 with me was always like, everyone prays in a different way. There have been times I've got on my knees. I kind of say, I'm afraid, you know, I have to be honest with all this. I would love to say I get on my knees every day and pray. I kind of say that for special occasions, and I know that's probably wrong, because I know it's really helpful and I ought to, but there are times when I really need that extra power. But I do, what I do have is I have an absolute internal dialogue with the God of my understanding, and I check it out. And I heard someone say something quite interesting. It came out of the blue for him. He was in a meeting, and he said, when I'm suddenly I find myself disconnected and unhappy and kind of blah, blah, blah. So I suddenly realised it's because I haven't kind of checked in. And it was a while back he said it, and I thought, that's just perfect. It's what I need to do. I have to check in on a sort of like all the time sometimes. But it is that kind of thing of, you know, I kind of tend to just look at the sky. My higher power is just, I know it wraps around me. I know it's there all the time. I know it was there when I was using. I know it was there when I was sitting on the edge of that pavement. I know it was there. And I know it's what brought me into recovery. And it wraps around me. Because the thing I think about the drink and the drugs, I am a great believer in forces of light and forces of darkness. And for me, the drugs and the alcohol, when they're in my system, it blocks everything. It blocks the light. It blocks my God. The darkness is there, and it's strong, and it will grow. And there's that whole great big thing, you know, well, I know that what I give my energy to grows. So if I give my energy to an obsession, it will grow. If I give my energy to the solution, it will grow. And, you know, I don't, you know, I waver. I'm human. And, you know, I'm an addict. So when obsession creeps in, it's really hard, you know, to sometimes curtail it and get down with my God. I have other bosses in recovery, and she always keeps saying, get down with God, get down with God. And so, okay, get down with God. Vesa, I love it. And, but no, I kind of, what I will do is try and check in. And I have had three sponsors, one who went to live abroad, one who was around for a while and then relapsed, is back now. We're all recovering addicts, do you know what I mean? And at the beginning I put my sponsor in poster, we're all recovering addicts helping each other. And I know this with the sponsors that I work with, the amount they give back to me, the amount, I was in kind of a bad headspace a few nights ago and I had a sponsor ring about some work she was doing in the step four. My head's there immediately in with her, with the work with step four, and all my stuff is gone. And it's that beautiful thing about, we get a better perspective about our lives. If I'm in this and I can be with other recovering addicts, I get perspective. If I'm not, my perspective's gone. It's out the window completely. And the 12 is, you know, for me, trying to practice these principles in all my affairs. I try, don't always do it, but I do try, and I'm aware of them. And that thing about honesty, that is honesty with myself, first and foremost. You know, if I can't be honest with myself, I can't be honest with anybody else, that's for sure. Open-mindedness, try. I do try. I'm not bad, I'm okay with that one. You know, I've seen enough, and I've done enough, and I, you know. The willingness, my sponsor's sitting there, it comes and goes. And but, you know, I hadn't heard, the meeting I wanted to go to yesterday, well, it didn't happen, and I suddenly found myself frantic. You know, that feeling of frantic. I've got to hear something. I've got to hear some good stuff. I've got to hear some recovery. So I went onto the website and I heard this guy do this chair, and it was a brilliant chair. And he said this thing again that I loved. And he said the three basics. And he said the three basics: prayer, meetings, don't pick up. And if I can do that, then it opens me up to my sponsor, you know, to the rest of it, to working a program. But those are, for me, the three basics. And it was just perfect, you know, prayer, meetings, don't pick up. And if we do pick up, we know where to come back. And we know where we'll be loved. And I absolutely love it. You know, I knew when I came in here that all of us sitting in the room, if we think of the walk out onto the streets, it is freezing, it is raining, it is disgusting. This is where I was 7 years ago, out there. And I see enough people out there now. And we are in this room. Look how many of us are out there. Aren't that many of us? We are the tip of the iceberg and in here. And not all of us stay here. So it is gold, this stuff. It is, I really want to hang on to it. I really, really want to hang on to it. And I'm an addict, and I am I'm aware enough to know that if I don't do the stuff I'm supposed to do, I'm just as likely to go out as anyone. And it is absolutely just for the day. Those children didn't deserve to go through what they went through, but they know that I'm there. They know that it's illness. They, you know, they're coming to that age where, you know, little Theo, he's a skater, he loves skateboarding, and he got this a couple of days ago, it was so sweet. He'd gone off to the shop and he came back, and we've got this really nosy neighbours downstairs, and they phoned and they went, "We've just seen Theo lurking in the garden and he's left this plastic bag under the hedge. And would you like to come and look at it before we throw it away?" I went down, there's some rolling tobacco. There he'd found this box of, kind of, they were like fake hash cookies. They were like novelty cookies because he was going to this party on Friday. And you know, just the most innocent thing you've ever seen in your life. And he was stricken with kind of like, "Oh God, Mum's going to find out, oh shit," you know. And so we sat down and talked, and he was bright red. And I just said to him, "The only thing to know is, you know, I'm recovering the stuff I've done, you know, and this is me here, and you can talk to me." And the only thing I wanted him to learn from that was he doesn't have to have secrets. That is what kept me ill for so long. I couldn't tell anyone. I had this great thing. I have made my bed. I have destroyed it. I have burnt every bridge. Now this is the bed you're going to have to lie in. And it wasn't the truth. Because this illness will lie to us. Because this illness wishes us dead. And we are all in this room to get well. And I love this stuff. You know, again, I shut my eyes. I see those boys' faces. It's enough. It's enough. And I hope I have said something that will help someone. That's all. Ego outside, that's all. You know, some humility in that. If I've said one thing that someone might remember at some point that helps, that's good enough. There are not enough days in my lifetime, if I live to be very old, to do justice to the gratitude I have for not being out there and for having had 7 years rebuilding my life and loving those boys. And I think I'll end it there.